Welcome to our first podcast on sustainability in the biopharma and medtech sectors. I'm Anna Scanlon from the iEd Hub, which is a joint project between Munster Technological University Cork and University College Cork, and we're funded through HCI Pillar 3 investment. Our primary focus is to work hand in hand with industry to provide them with graduates who can hit the ground running on entry to the workplace. So our lecturers, industry liaison officers and workplace coordinators have all come directly from industry. So these guys know what they're talking about. And if you want to learn more about us, check out www.iedhub.ie. I am here today with some of my colleagues to get their insight on sustainability within biopharma and medtech. And here with me at the moment is Brian Dillon, our industry liaison officer, Mick Kilkelly, our workplace coordinator, both are from UCC, and two of our lecturers from MTU are David Healy and Claire O'Brien. And I should have stuck doctor before all those names, but we'll move on. So David, actually, would you like to introduce yourself a bit better, please?
Yeah, so I'm Dr. David Healy from, and I'm a lecturer here in MTU in the Biopharm School of Manufacturing Engineering in the engineering department school itself. So I'm part of the iEd Hub in developing new programs specific for the biopharm and pharmaceutical industry, for industry with industry, as we say, so working with industry to develop the programs. And so far, so good, we have a number of programs and modules developed to date. And some of which are going out there marketing as we speak for September 2024 intake, in particular the new product introduction.
Perfect. And actually, Mick, do you want to give a little...
Yeah, Michael Kilkelly is my name, and I'm a process chemist by nature. I spent 30 years in the small molecule API business, mostly here in Cork, but a few trips in England and up to Shannon. And I suppose I came into the iEd Hub just over a year ago, transitioned from industry to education. And similar to, you know, Dave's comments there, it's really about us designing in conjunction with the industry relevant material. And I suppose I have a big interest in sustainability, which I think everyone should at this stage, because it's an existentialist possible crisis subject, you know, that we need to embed into absolutely everything we teach, whatever the subject matter is, you know.
I suppose on sustainability, David or Mick, whoever wants to go first, what do you see as being the most misunderstood factors of sustainability in biopharma or medtech?
So look, I suppose biopharmaceutical companies, we all know the role they play in life science in terms of medicines and health and whatnot. I suppose doing a quick kind of Google there on sustainability for biopharma companies, you'll see, you know, references around the supply chain activities required to make and move drugs, which obviously this can considerably impact the environment. So I think it's a quick reference there. I saw not so long ago was more than 70% of the emissions produced by life sciences and the healthcare companies originated in their supply chain. And then again, I suppose if you look beyond emissions, the biopharma industry then generates that as well. Millions of tons of waste that would be plastic, for example, annually. So obviously there's an element of sustainability work, I guess, considering for the biopharma piece itself. And I know a lot of companies are doing just that to date. I don't know, Mick, do you want to throw anything in on that?
Yeah, I suppose, you know, I specifically, you know, I'm not targeting one small molecules or large molecules over big molecules. But if I look at the big molecule, the biologics industry and the way it's kind of set up, you have these huge capital costs to build these, plants that are often close to €1 billion. A lot of the cost is building clean rooms. And the running costs of clean rooms are absolutely astronomical in terms of energy usage, mainly due to the amount of air changes, you know, 24/7, air changes could be up to 80 air changes an hour. And in addition to that, you have the entry requirements of people with all this single-use PPE, which is, you know, which doesn't go to even landfill, but it's biological waste. So huge impact on the environment, huge negative impact. And I suppose the question I would ask people in the industry is why we're putting human beings into clean rooms, because they're the main source of contamination. And, you know, we take some kind of very lateral approach and look at putting robots in there. I know that sounds sci-fi, but the technology is already there in the motor industry, for example. And you know, these are kind of challenging questions. It's one thing to put up a load of solar panels on a biologics facility that has, you know, a huge impact on the environment from plastic, you know, a lot of single use. So I think there needs to be kind of radical questions asked.
What about all the jobs though, Mick? Sustainability of jobs and stuff.
Yeah. So I was waiting for that answer, and I'll give you a context. My dad worked in the printing industry back in the 70s. And he was one of those people who used to use the old typesetting. Mm-hmm. He was a typesetter, and they introduced computers. And the big question was, we're all going to be done out of jobs. And the opposite happened. And they all reskilled, and the local newspaper tripled its output over a number of years, and actually created jobs. So it's a question. So, you know, we started a robotics industry. There you go.
And like, I'm just thinking back to what David was saying there about supply chain being one of the biggest challenges for sustainable. Have you any thoughts on that?
Yeah, and just recently I had this chat with somebody from one of the companies in Ringaskiddy. If you look at, again, I'm just picking out biologics because it's in my mind at the moment. The vast majority of the drug substance produced is, you know, stored and transported at minus 40 degrees. And the amount of energy and you know, the carbon footprint of putting those kind of thermally unstable compounds into the supply chain is massive. And again, given the amount of money that's put into it and you know, the possible loss of products from temperature excursions, there is an argument to say that, you know, pump money into finding ways of stabilizing these kind of compounds at higher temperatures, possibly even room temperature, and it would eliminate that issue. You know.
And is that something that's kind of being researched at all at the moment, or surely since COVID-19? I mean, we won't go on about COVID-19, but there was a cold chain challenge there that everything had to be transported at minus 70, was it?
Minus 70, minus 40. Yeah. So, I mean, if you think about it, it's crazy. Mm-hmm. If you're from another industry looking in, you'd go, oh my God, they're insane, you know. Mm-hmm. I've even heard companies talking about hiring private jets to transport material, which is really going against the grain, you know. So I do think that there needs to be kind of a radical view on how we do things, you know.
Definitely, yeah. No, I agree there, Mick. We definitely need a transformational change from the way that the industry probably has been operating to create a sustainable future. But I do think probably pharmaceutical companies are rethinking how drug products are developed, manufactured, transported, administered, and disposed of across probably the full cycle, including, you know, operations and the value chain in the healthcare systems. But I suppose if we actually look at the industry as a kind of a functional unit of the product, if we start off at the beginning of we have, you know, potentially 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 6 possible areas for sustainability, you know, to explore. So obviously the products developed at any of your one would be your raw materials. So there's a potential focus work package there around sustainability. You then have your manufacturing that you could have a work package to investigate sustainability. You could have packaging, for example, followed by distribution, which we mentioned briefly there. The use, whether that's single use type drugs, and then probably the end of life as well. Yeah. So there's six. But then that's just spitballing the six there, potential areas for thinking and assessing in terms of product, pharma product life cycle, in terms of the sustainability magnified glass, as it were. And then if you start looking at the whole product life cycle, and looking at it from a sustainability window, it becomes probably a bit more structured in terms of how you deal each with each of those individual packages, work packages from a sustainability perspective.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, you know, and I think if you can, you know, in terms of teaching, you know, if you can embed that philosophy early in the teaching process to look at that broad arc of, because we're all in our silos, we're all in our specialist silos, that's a very good point.
And one of the courses we mentioned that we, you know, we're obviously involved in developing new courses, and one of those is a postgraduate course for the pharma and the biopharmaceutical industry, and it's regulated new product introduction and tech transfer. And part of the development of each of those, the modules for that particular course, we had to take sustainability into consideration. It's part of module design now. Apart from learning outcomes for the student, you have to consider sustainability as well. And so we've tried to do just that in terms of the introducing it to the learnings of the course as part of that particular MSc program, where we have an opportunity when you're bringing a new product into house, you have an opportunity to look at the lean elements of it, so making it more efficient, but you also have an opportunity to now look at the sustainability elements of it, because once the whole process comes into the pharma production suite, it becomes validated, and once it's validated, it's very hard to make changes there. So I think hopefully with the courses such as our IADOP developed course on MPI, we'll be able to introduce some learnings on sustainability relevant for the pharma, biopharma sector.
Thanks, Dave. Brian, would you like to introduce yourself?
Yes, thanks, Anna. So my name is Brian Dillon. I'm the Industry Liaison Officer with the IADOP based in UCC. Prior to that, I worked in global supply chain and pharmaceutical business for nearly 18 to 19 years. Part of that remit was responsible for the full supply chain and particularly the sustainability program. I think if I reflect back and if I reflect forward, I think there's a couple, when you talk about sustainability, there's a couple of key things. One, sustainability is not well understood at industry level, despite what everybody might say. So you ask anyone who is not well, who's outside maybe the core group, and they have buzzwords, and they have carbon, and they have greenhouse gases, and they have, you know, maybe scope one, but they actually, very few people really understand it in its full entity, because it's probably not a priority for them. So anything you start a conversation, you should always start a conversation with explaining the 101 of what is sustainability. Then I think, you know, if you've got to look at supply chain through two lenses. The first lens is, what are the products we make today and what's the full value chain? And Mick touched on some of that there, talking about the cold chain. But then, you know, we talk, you know, so in terms of products today, do we understand from cradle to grave what their carbon footprint is? So right back to the, you know, the very first raw material, perhaps even coming out of the ground, through the manufacturing processes, through the support processes, the support manufacturing, for example, the air conditioning. So can we work our way back to whatever gases are being used in the air conditioning system, all the way through to the finished product, the packaging, you know, the circular economy. Because there's one piece of work, you know, about products that are already manufactured, and, you know, how do we take reduced carbon footprint of that as much as possible? Because the key to understand that, that's a product that's in existence. So the file behind it in terms of how to make it has already been filed. So any change to that is really very hard. So if you want to substitute a raw material or substitute a manufacturing process, you've got to go through the whole validation life cycle. And that takes a ton of time and it's very hard to do. So clearly, and then NPI in context, that is, you know, bringing a product from Singapore to Cork or from Italy to Ireland, or, you know, you're then looking, you know, how can I tweak around the edges and, you know, maybe waste segregation or, you know, that's you. So you're looking in context of that. Or if you're building a new site or locating this manufacturing, how can you make sure that the whole value chain is short as possible? And the third lens to look through to, sorry, Dave, just finished point. The third lens to look through to is, well, if you're bringing a brand new product in and you're going back to product development, you know, what products, you know, what processes are being engineered from the outset? Because once they're engineered in, excuse me, go to Steve.
I can edit that out.
that
might be our eyelid opener, a little.
That should be the
wake
opener.
Up sneeze.
Because once they're engineered, they're locked in. So if you look at a company like Cytiva, their burning ambition is that their filtration media is designed into a Pfizer process to make a new product. Because once it's designed in, God no man won't get it out. Mm. But once you know, and the chemicals you use, the process you use in that design is really very important. So there are the three lens I look through, you know. Does everybody understand what we're talking about? Are we looking through the supply chain of the existing products and then products of the future?
Yeah. So I think Brian touched nicely there on a particular topic around sustainability opportunities before and after regulatory approval, because you've got two options. And really, as Brian pointed out, you know, you've got probably maybe slightly more at the before approval stage, but after the approval stage or after the validation stage, you are limited in what you can implement or change in terms of the actual sustainability aspects of it. And again, I think if you go back to that life cycle phase that we were talking about around, you know, raw materials, manufacturing, packaging and services, distribution, use, end of life, you can look at each of those and explore them from a before regulatory approval to see what, you know, opportunities you might have. And then also after regulatory approval. And I think it, you know, it's been referenced in places, you know, that it's been postulated that up to like 80% of a product's environmental impacts are determined at the development phase. Yeah. So that brings up that piece, you know, the development is the most powerful and cost-effective point to address the resource footprints of future products, essentially, with early development having the most impact on possible changes, you know. And this then, I suppose, highlights the importance of embedding the sustainability in pharmaceutical research and development, in line with the chemistry, manufacturing controls, timelines, and so on. You know.
Yeah. And I agree with you, Dave. There, as a former process development chemist, you know, the education piece is very important, because, you know, as say a chemist who's say developing a small molecule process, generally the normal kind of academic training is, you know, make your molecule, make it as pure as possible and concentrate in the yield, and all the other, the amount of solvent or the amount of waste you're generating is almost like an anecdote, or you know, it's forgotten about. And embedding that early, I think, particularly in kind of, you know, the PhD level, is, you know, in the labs, even simple things like, you know, laboratory chemicals should reflect what's actually, you know, practical on the market. You know, they should be using commercially available, you know, large scale commercially available compounds. You know, so at that level, so that's a kind of a granular level. There's definitely an education piece there. On a global level, there's another issue coming down the line, and that's, you know, COP28. And, you know, if you believe the chatter from COP28 about, you know, phasing out fossil fuels. And of course, everybody is talking rightly about how do we replace the energy generating side of things, you know, with wind and solar and what have you. But the small molecule business is entirely dependent on the materials derived from fossil fuels. So there's a possibility of, you know, a burning platform coming down the line for companies to radically look at where they're getting their raw materials from. And it's really interesting. The fine chemicals industry are way ahead of the game in terms of strategy like that. BASF, the world's largest producer of fine chemicals, have a very aggressive policy, I think, to 2040, I think, to go carbon zero. And these are the main suppliers of solvents and chemicals. And they're looking at, you know, radical things like carbon capture to, you know, and you know, I think that's something the pharma industry isn't really paying much attention to. It's 20 odd years away, but it could catch up with us. And that could feed through to restrictive legislation through the EU, through the ECHA. Or, the industry got caught napping with REACH there a few years ago. There's certainly a lot of pressures coming down the line.
And like, how are they proposing to replace that fossil fuel exactly? Like, is it true?
Well, if you look,
everything,
the fossil fuel, say the energy side of it is one thing. It's the raw materials is what's not been really talked about much, because if you look, solvents come from fossil fuels, essentially, you know, or most of your chemicals will derive from. So if you remove that industry, you remove a huge source of fossil fuels. But so there's definitely a radical view that needs to be taken.
Yeah.
You know, and it has to be for new products. You know, I agree with you both, but it has to be the long term vision. You know, of companies, or we're out of business in 20 years' time. You know?
Just that, even as you're talking there, Mick, you touched on a good point. So I think we all agreed. You know, the sustainability opportunities are probably, there's a lot more opportunities perhaps in the before the regulatory approval or validation phase. And then if we take that concept and bring it back to an IAD hub, what can IAD hub do for sustainability in the pharma, biopharma sector? There's potentially an opportunity of a learning firm, like you said, maybe a PhD students to open the, you know, develop a potential learning around opening the mindset for a researcher or a PhD student in the area of pharmaceuticals to look at, you know, alternatives, you know, whether that's water-based synthesis instead of organic solvent or green chemistry principles, and get them to try and embed that into at a PhD level, for example, you know, when they're considering their research and their development activities.
Yeah, no, and that's a great point, and I think that's, you know, that's get them young.
Exactly, yeah.
Get them into
the learning mindset, the learning embedded, into mindset early.
Yeah, I think that's important, you know, because it'll be their industry, you know, in 20 years' time, or, you know, or less even, you know.
I think I think in general I'd be quite pessimistic about the rate of progress in the biopharma industry. It's really dead slow, and they haven't tackled you know, any of the really burning issues. And you make a point about reach, like that's been just hobbling around there for ages as well, and the industry haven't really properly tackled it. But the one ray of hope is the younger generation coming through. Ardent, so are really committed to trying and making change, you know. And, you know, the question then becomes, from an academic point of view, how do we equip them to do that? But they are the one ray of hope here, that they won't be as lackadaisical as their parental generation, because I think we haven't done a great job in driving it forward.
Yeah, and I suppose in terms of the industry, and it's a difficult question to ask the pharma industry, you know, so we talk about, you know, manufacturing and reducing the impact of manufacturing, but there is an element of overproduction as well, driven by overprescription, you know, and this is a difficult topic to tackle with any pharmaceutical company, because everyone wants to make more and make more money. And the reality of it is, and particularly in the States, you know, with the opiate epidemics, you know, or, you know, crisis, there is, you know, at the patient end and at the prescription, over prescription. So you have over prescription, incorrect prescription, and then you have, you know, the expiry dates of tons and tons and billions of these very expensively manufactured products. So there is an element there. You could cut 20% off the carbon emissions bill by tackling the overprescription, but it would take an incredible political will to deal with. But it has to be asked. It has to be addressed. You know.
And that probably touches into the distribution phase as well, around forecast planning on the back end of that. Then, you know, ensuring that the correct amount is forecast in terms of manufacturing.
Yeah. No, absolutely.
Yeah.
I don't know, just from someone that doesn't have the knowledge that you have, it just looks like a tangled web of problems. So if you make a change in one you know, point along the way. It impacts many other points, say the points that David called out. I suppose if you were challenged to make a significant difference in the shortest time frame to improving sustainability, what might the first direction be that you go in?
If it was from my perspective, I'd be targeting the development phase again, because you can have the biggest impact there for the newer products. That's not to say there's opportunities in newer products that are being manufactured already. There are, but I think if you want the biggest bang for your buck, 80% of the product's environmental impacts are probably determined at the development phase. In a nutshell, and then I think if you take your at the development phase, you have to have a holistic view of the complete life cycle, and you look at the sustainability across raw materials, manufacturing, packages and devices, distribution, uses and end of life. You can start breaking down targets groups where you can look at the sustainability opportunities individually, and then if you take those individual groups and you zone in further, you can start looking at both those for a pre-approval opportunity, pre-approval and launch opportunity, and a post-approval and launch opportunity, and see what examples can be explored. And that potentially there is a roadmap for looking at sustainability opportunities in the biopharmaceutical sector, both before and after regulatory validation, approval and whatnot, and launch of each of life cycle stages of the products.
Thanks, Dave. What about you, Brian? Have you any thoughts?
I think the quickest win in the short term, unfortunately, lies outside the pharma industry, and that's generating more. How do we generate more energy from renewables and get that into the industry? I think within the industry, then I think we have to, with the regulators, look at the whole packaging piece and say, how can we take out materials from the pharma packaging process? You know, if you look at standard packaging, it has a box, a label, maybe blister pack. Can we go things like e-labeling? Can we go to e-leaflets? You know, and can the regulators get behind those processes to enable that? And I think that in itself would be a big step forward, because that will attack a huge amount in the scope 3 and of the sustainability agenda.
Yeah, and what about you, Mick? Have you any?
Well, if you look at, the success of say GMP over the last 30 years, in protecting patients, we should have the same philosophy in protecting the environment, and there's, a very nice catch phrase, QBD, quality by design, that's embedded into a lot of the early stage development. And, and we can trademark this now, sustainability by design, SBD. I think there needs to be an equal emphasis. If you look at pharma companies and you look at the distribution of roles and departments, you'll find that their quality departments are multiples of their EHS departments, right? Which is kind of odd, really, in many ways. And I think there needs to be much more emphasis within the companies. Very simple, get more people in there that are working on these things as a priority, similar to the way they've done for the GMP or GXP side of things. So there you go. So yeah, sustainability by design.
Have you like a one-line overview of what sustainability is directly for biopharma? Because we've talked about lots of elements of sustainability, but from my point of view, I would have just seen sustainability as being carbon footprint and renewable energy, and not really beyond that, kind of waste management. Do you have like a one-liner each for what sustainability is?
That's a good question. Very good question. I suppose product design, ensuring that the quality of products remain available in the marketplace while moving towards zero pollution for air, water, and soil, or whatnot, maybe. I don't know, is that a good enough one-liner there? But it is about making it better. But the key thing, obviously, would be to ensure that the quality of the products remain as well, and that'll be the challenge, you know, that they're, that the potents are as active as they need to be.
I think how I find sustainability is how to get the right balance between, you know, social factors, economic factors, and environmental factors, so that they coexist well rather than in conflict with each other. Because right now, they're all in conflict with each other, and the one that's losing out most is probably the environment.
Yeah, it's pretty good. Yeah, and Mick, you want?
Yeah, I think you have to ask the question: what will our great grandchildren, you know, say about us and our treatment of the planet and people? And I think that's the question we always have to ask anytime we're doing something or building something. You know, think on that scale, have a broader, a longer horizon. We tend to just look at what's ahead 5-10 years, intergenerational view on what we're. Our legacy is going to be, you know, so that to me is sustainability.
Yeah.
So giving our kids a nice planet to live on.
And do you want to introduce yourself, Claire?
Yeah, I'm Claire O'Brien. I'm a lecturer at the IH Hub. I work in the MTU side of projects in the engineering faculty. My background is in metallurgy or metallurgy, depending on where, what part of the world you live in. And I worked in the medtech sector for 14 years before joining IH Hub project. For me, sustainability, when you're looking at medtech or medical device development, is all about thinking about the full life cycle. So the end-to-end life cycle of any product. And so that looking at every step along the way, every process that product goes through, and thinking about how you would design for the full life cycle, taking the sustainability aspects into account.
That's interesting. Like, where is your perspective coming from to kind of farm?
Yeah, so I worked in more process development in my time in medtech. So looking at the technologies and processes needed to make medical devices, specifically our orthopedics. And as part of that, we would have looked at things like sourcing. My own background is metals, right? So I'll focus in on that for a second from a technical point of view. Sourcing metals, where do they come from? Is it ethically mined? Is it sustainable from a cost even point of view? Because obviously the cost of the metal that goes into, say, your knee or hip would be passed on to the customer or the patient. So thinking about where your source is and making sure that source can continue, and not picking a material that may be in low supply or something, or maybe highly rare. So looking at both the material performance, but also the sourcing and material, would have been a big part of how we as engineers looked at it. So we couldn't pick a material that, yeah, great, it performed really well, but it was really difficult to source or really, really expensive. So we had to find solutions that delivered the customer's needs from a mechanical performance point of view, but also made sure that it was cost effective and continued source would not be an issue. So an example would be, you'd always try to avoid something that was single sourced. If there's only one place that can make this particular ceramic and they had a, God forbid, a fire or a flood or whatever, then you all of a sudden have no way of getting that material, so you can't make the products to your customer or your patient has their surgery cancelled. So that part of the supply chain and the material sustainability would have been a big factor in our considerations in the process and material selection.
Yeah, and like, are there providers in Ireland for the raw materials and stuff, or is that all international?
Internationally sourced, but even the sub-supplier, say the company I worked in, would have not only looked at their first tier source, but they also would have made that sure that first tier source was ensuring it was sourcing from an ethical source, so that you looked at the full chain of where that material came from. So there were some issues in the industry in general, I don't know, 20 years ago before my time in the business, and it was one of those lessons learned where some of the titanium mining sources were not mining it as pure as they should have. Mm-hmm. And then that was an issue for many different companies throughout the supply chain. So they had to put very tight controls in place on how that material was delivered and what its specifications were and all that kind of thing. So that would have been one of the considerations, is where am I getting it from? How much is it going to cost the patient to have this material in there? And, you know, is there a continued source or a risk of maybe not having a continued source?
Yeah, and I suppose I was talking earlier to the biopharma team members about supply chain and logistics, and like you're talking about it there. Are there any kind of, so that's one factor of sustainability, say in terms of waste or in terms of transport? Are there any particular challenges?
Yes. So the other area then would have been reuse. So in some cases, I won't get into the technicality of the process because the confidentiality and things, but there will be certain processes where you use something and then you have to remove an excess amount of it. And there would have been a big focus on trying to see with that excess, is there a way that that could be put back into the process, reprocessed, even if it wasn't reprocessed in the medical device sector, would there be a way to ensure that it got fed in and got reprocessed in another sector to make sure that it went through? Like the circular economy would have been a big focus of the business at a corporate level now and at a local level. So thinking about circular economy and the reuse of the material, either within your own process or again within, you know, wider use of that generic material, you know, that kind of way. So yeah, we would have done projects where we actually spent a long time testing materials, showing that if you had an X percent of recycled material, that yeah, that would still perform in a particular way and things like that.
Yeah, really interesting. And excuse me, what would be the other main challenges that you would see in terms of kind of supporting sustainability? So I know you've spoken quite broadly.
Are there any particular bugbears?
I think not bugbears, but areas that I saw done really well, I would say maybe, where they weren't about materials because that was my area. But things like the manufacturing site that I worked in had a really large quantity of high temperature furnaces, so had a huge power draw because of those furnaces. And the business invested in wind turbines to be able to ensure that 100% of its power came from the turbine and that they were no longer using fossil fuels to make those furnaces run, essentially. So not a project I was directly involved in, but colleagues of mine were, and it was a major passion project, but it also obviously had to have a business return from any business point of view. So I think the way my positive view on it is that most projects, when you're pitching for a project in the business, you have to show either a financial return, a sustainability return, or a quality aspect to, you know, ensure quality of the product. And ideally, if you'd all three, that was just a complete no-brainer that you would do that project. So things like that. So power sources would have been a big one that was focused on from a sustainability point of view in a really positive way. And then materials for packaging and things like that. Again, not an area I was involved in, but ensuring they were working with packaging suppliers to design the packaging for the product in a way that protected the product as much as it needed to, but wasn't excessive, so that you weren't using excessive plastics and stuff like that. So they'd have been two areas that I would have seen directly, not in my own projects, but in colleagues' projects that were really, really positive and, you know, were just supported by the business because it's the right thing to do, you know, as well.
Yeah, no, it's really interesting. And like, there's a lot of crossover with the biopharma view and sustainability, especially packaging that comes up time and time again. And I know the risk factors would be slightly different, say, for contamination. So Mick highlighted how clean rooms is hugely impactful on air. You've to kind of refilter air up to 80 times a day, things like that. But so one of the solutions he saw was to replace people who are the primary source of contamination, replace people with robots, and you can see how that would work. But I was kind of wondering about the sustainability of jobs and stuff. But jobs get
jobs, it's and boxes,
yeah. It's repurposing skills rather than absolutely replacing jobs. And do you see something similar?
There would have been a big focus on like that packaging and clean rooms and all that. Or similarly, like it's a different process, but you still have to have a sterile pack for your product. Absolutely big focus in just efficiencies in those spaces. I'd say at a cultural level, then there was a massive culture across business of lean and 5S and 6S is what it would be referred to in terms of, like, let's say I worked in a lab, for example. You know, you wouldn't necessarily think of a lab as a place where you could look at sustainability, but if you just look at waste reduction, you're automatically kind of looking at sustainability. So if you're using less boxes, less gloves, less, you know, obviously you use what you need to use, but only use what you need to use. And we would have done a lot of mini projects at a very kind of local level on just making sure we were efficient and tidy and as lean as possible, as paperless as possible, all those kind of things to just avoid waste when we didn't need to, you know. Even simple things like people using goggles and then just throw them in the bin, you know, trying to get just people thinking in a really just, you know, the way I suppose we all do now at home. 10 years ago, we were doing that in industry as well in the lab, just, you know, at a local level. So, yeah.
Yeah, and that's very interesting now, actually, that you brought about kind of reducing paper where possible. I know Mick kind of meant to touch on that earlier, but didn't get a chance to, but you know, there was a study came out there recently about AI kind of showing how electronic data isn't weightless. When we compare it to kind of paper and stuff. So there's a whole issue around there. So
data centers are sucking down big cars.
So it's you know, you remove less paper, but you increase the draw on the environment in another way. Do you know?
Yeah. So, I mean, we're on slightly off topic, Anna, but even if you think about how many photos you take on your phone of your kids or your dog, the more is in the cloud, the more is been in a data center having to be stored there for a second time. Like, so yeah, we all need to be conscious of our data, you know, sustainability of our data usage and stuff like that as well. Absolutely.
Yeah. And I suppose in terms of education then, to try and weave that into courses, I know it's something that the IAID Hub does anyway in both UCC and MTU courses. Sustainability is discussed at kind of a granular level as well, but kind of more broadly outside of academia, say, or I suppose to put it better, academia communicating to the public about sustainability in industry. Do you see ways that could be improved?
It's not something I really thought about, but I don't think it's academia's role to tell the public about what industry is doing. I think it's industry's role to tell them what they're doing.
Yeah.
So let's say whatever big company or small company that you're working in, like, it is, I suppose, important that those companies sell their sustainability message, and that it's not greenwashing, because some people do get very cynical about greenwashing as well. So I think, for example, the company I worked in that had the wind turbine, it was pretty obvious there was a wind turbine there and a lot of people knew about it. But when we brought transition year students in, they always got it towards the wind turbine and got the data showing them why it was important, why it worked, why it was needed, what the environmental benefit was, what the business case was, and just showcased it to them. So I think it's the industry's own job to do that. I think it's academia's job to give people the skills and the questioning mindset to be curious about it and to challenge it and to question it and to not accept the current standards and things like that. So I think maybe that's where I see our role is. Yeah, we can build it into modules, but we build in the more mindset, I think, would be important, as well as like specific assessments in my program that address ethical sourcing material, things like that. So they're very specific, but I think it's more about teaching people about being curious and challenging and not taking on, you know, accepting. I suppose being able to go into a project team and say, hey, listen, we're wasting a load of this and that's not okay. And, you know, having the, I suppose, bravery and the curiosity to be able to challenge those kind of things and not accept the status quo and stuff, I think is probably what at a broad level academia should be teaching people.
Yeah, very,
you
very good.
Specifics in your modules that, you know, are relevant to one particular topic or another, but that'd be the more broader thing I think we need to be doing, I think.
Yeah, very good. And do you see any kind of company or education body doing that particularly well on a kind of a more global scale, or are you aware of any examples?
I'm not specifically, other than big American corporate companies, to say the one I worked in or similar ones like that, all have sustainability goals and they have community responsibility goals as well, and they kind of put those together sometimes. So they are very good at articulating what those goals are and how they meet those goals at a national level and at a global level and all that kind of thing. So I think they do it very well. I suppose I wonder, you know, Ireland Inc., I'm not sure we're there yet at doing it, you know, across the board. But big companies have very clear goals. I'd say as well, say, for example, Engineers Ireland mandate that the engineering programmes across the Irish university have sustainability goals built into them as well. So some of it's mandated. And again, you know, you'd hope people aren't box ticking or greenwashing by doing that either, that there is true innovation in that sense. Like, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And what you would be, if you were to go for a quick win in kind of improving sustainability in medtech, a quick win over the next few years, what rung on the ladder would you target? And I know that's a kind of a tricky question.
Yeah, I don't know, because I would say
Probably the quick win is to actually give individual accountability to the employees so that you put it back on everybody to come up with, well, where are the ways then my that I can see and I can do something about? Because I think if you put these big, huge, lofty goals in, they seem a bit detached from what you can do as an individual. So I think the quick win for any big company in medtech would be to actually put it back on people and put their onus on them to come up with specific goals and objectives. Something in their own personal goals and objectives that they can impact, truly impact in the space. That would be how, just totally off the cuff, that I would do it.
That's great. Look, if you're happy to leave it with that, I'll say thanks very, very much.